Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gab Fest for Thursday, August 10th, 2017, the Like the World Has Never Seen edition. I'm Emily Bazelon. I am a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, and I am hosting today because David is I don't know where. I am here, however, with John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation in Washington, D.C. Hey, John.
Hi.
And also joining us happily is Jamel Bowie, who is, I believe, the chief political correspondent for Slate. Hey, Jamel.
Hello, and that is my correct title.
And a contributor to CBS News. Let's not
leave that out, Emily.
Let's get... Okay, we have three topics for you today. As usual on this week's GabFest, we are first going to talk about the escalating threat making between the Trump administration, the president himself, and North Korea. Then we're going to talk about the fight over sanctuary cities, which is ramping up, particularly between Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And then the notorious, to my mind, obnoxious Google memo. What does James Damore's manifesto say about tech culture, about the work culture of Google, and did he, its author, deserve to be fired? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, we're going to talk about this super interesting article in The Atlantic about how smartphones have altered the lives of teenagers. It's by Jean Twenge. If you're not yet a Slate Plus member, please go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to sign up. So for our first topic, North Korea. The president told reporters at his golf club, where he is not on vacation this week, that, quote, North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen, if they do continue to threaten. So immediately, as far as I can tell, North Korea did issue another threat, warning that it is considering a strike that would create an enveloping fire around Guam, which is a U.S. territory. To me, this all seems alarming, to have this kind of escalating bellicose rhetoric at a moment when we are learning that North Korea has surprisingly miniaturized a warhead that could fit on top of one of its missiles, making its threats and its military capabilities seem greater than they were before. So, John, for a long time on the show, we have wondered about how seriously to take President Trump's words. We've learned from a report in the New York Times that he was improvising when he made this big fire and fury like the world has never seen statement. He was looking at what appeared to be a set of talking points, but those talking points were actually about the opioid crisis. And he hadn't really checked in with his advisors about making this kind of public statement. So what do we make of these words? Is it one thing to ignore Trump's words or kind of downplay them when we're having a sort of domestic dispute or debate? And is it different when he is telegraphing a message outside of the country to our rivals and adversaries?
Well, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, obviously, the facts as you've laid them out are as they are. And so it seems awfully shambling for something that's this serious. And it obviously challenges that the idea that the president, when surrounded by competent military officials, will operate in a kind of, you know, linear fashion, or maybe it wouldn't appear linear, but that it would be the product of some strategic thinking, some conversation, some not improvisation. Because the worry here, of course, is that when you're dealing with a totally unpredictable leader in North Korea, improvisation can get you stumbling into a conflict. You want to make sure that everybody thought this thing through. And if you're going to do the madman theory, the referring to what Nixon and Kissinger used to flirt with, or in fact try to employ, the idea that Nixon was like this, you know, warmongering, ready to go, ready to bomb the dickens out of the North Koreans as a way to kind of, as a negotiating posture, then that's a theory. You may not agree with it, but at least it's a strategy then you're going to try to employ. But in this case, it seemed like while that was maybe talked about in some general fashion, that the president went off and just improvised. If you take him obviously literally, he was drawing a red line and promising 2 days after, or I guess it was actually on the day of Nagasaki's anniversary, to unleash greater fury than the world had seen on the anniversary of a time we were reminded of pretty bad fire and fury. And that he drew a red line on threats and then North Korea crossed the red line and he did nothing about it. So it's just a, really curious. And if this was an effort to put pressure on China to deal with North Korea, in other words, boy, he really means it, then when you make a threat you don't follow up on, and then you're bluffing. So it seems to me to be, even if it was a show and an act, it seems to be an inefficient and ineffective one. So I don't know what to make of it.
Jamel, is there any good that can come of this? Do you fear that we're blundering our way into war? Is there something we could give the president credit for here that John and I are missing?
I mean, the argument for giving the president credit here is that this kind of blustery rhetoric is the only thing that North Korea understands, and that Kim Jong-un will take the United States more seriously if we are using the sort of bellicose rhetoric. I don't really think that's the case, but that's, I think, the argument that folks who support the president make. I don't know if there's a positive to take away from here. There is an argument that things may not be as dire as they seem, and that is predicated on a view of Kim Jong-un, a correct view, I think, that he is a fundamentally rational operator, and that North Korea is a rational state, and that it has no immediate interest in provoking a conflict, knowing full well that while it would be able to inflict devastating damage on its neighbors, it would take similar damage in return. I think one of the problems here for Americans and for the United States is that there is a wide consensus that the goal here ultimately is to disarm North Korea of nuclear weapons. And a realistic and frank analysis of the situation has to conclude that that's probably never going to happen, that North Korea is simply a nuclear-armed state and we have to learn to live with it and learn to somehow accommodate that reality. But as long as I think we believe that there is some way of turning back the clock and getting nuclear weapons away from North Korea, we're going to find ourselves in situations, at least, where, you know, if we the only option is to make threats. And then, as John pointed out, like, eventually, if you're making threats, you're going to have to show that those are credible threats. You can't just make threats and then back down on them.
Right. And then, of course, the problem is that to back up a threat like this is to wreak potentially untold destruction. I mean, even a conventional war, people use figures like 1 million casualties in North Korea and South Korea. And it just, the costs escalate incredibly quickly. It doesn't seem like there's some way to have a kind of limited conflict where we sort of check a box, you know, in the way that Trump did in Syria.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's just very hard to imagine how you could have a similar kind of small sign of backing up your threats in this case.
Also, the line that he drew, it just seems weird. I mean, I can understand saying to North Korea, like, cut the crap. We could, you know, turn you into shimmering glass if we wanted to, as a way to kind of be like, we're bigger than you are. And, you know, you may have 20 to 60 nuclear warheads, but you can't put them on top of a missile, and we have more than 4,000. So, but then stop there. Don't, like, make the triggering red line the thing that North Korea does on the half hour, which is make threats about the United States, because you know they're gonna do that, and then you won't have followed up. It was, and the other thing, of course, was bizarre, was the madman theory requires everybody to not say, ignore the madman. So the minute right after, Tillerson said, the Secretary of State, Tillerson said everybody should sleep peacefully at night.
Americans
Nothing's changed over
night.
The last 24 hours, when his boss had just said this incredibly incendiary thing. And this is not the first time that members of the foreign policy team have had to say, essentially, don't listen to what the president says. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley basically said, I don't pay attention to what he tweets. You know, but other countries do. And so what do you... Finally, I would just say that the greatest criticism the president leveled at President Obama on foreign policy, and that his certainly James Mattis and others leveled, was that basically when they drew the red line, when the president drew the red line in Syria, another improvisational moment, we should remind, that he didn't follow up on it. So now he seems to be duplicating that mistake.
Right. And if you're watching from abroad, you've now seen two American presidents in a row draw a red line and then not be able to back it up. And then one starts to wonder about how our credibility erodes abroad. And to me, it seems like a problem of a different order to have a president talking in such an unreliable way out and then projecting that speech outside the country. Like, it's one thing to have your grumpy old uncle saying terrible things at the dinner table inside the family, and another to have it be like the image that you project abroad. Jamel, does that make any sense to you, or do you think that that's...
It does make sense. I wanted to actually touch on that, but first I wanted to make a really quick point that I think is sort of under-examined in the conversation around nuclear weapons, which is that Tillerson's Americans Can Sleep Soundly at Night thing kind of presupposes that in a nuclear exchange, the United States would suffer untold devastation, which is probably not going to be the case. I mean, even in the worst case scenario, what's interesting to think, and what I'm not sure the public has grappled with, is a situation where Seoul or Tokyo is like wiped off the map, and the rest of the country is still, you know, Japan and South Korea is otherwise still intact, but this major city is gone. And I'm not sure that we have a language for discussing limited nuclear conflict that kind of upends the entire global status quo, but doesn't destroy everything. And that's just a observation.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I haven't thought about that at all. It's totally terrifying, but not destabilizing in the way that one usually thinks of nuclear war, in this like total way, right?
Right. But with regards to the president's rhetoric, this is something where you can kind of draw this parallel with Kim Jong-un and his father as well, which is with North Korea. We kind of all recognize that the North Korean leadership will talk in this insane way on the global stage, but that isn't necessarily a guide to their actions. And you have to kind of read the two separately. That has never been the case for an American president for the United States, but we're in this situation where the rhetoric of the president of the United States, to a large extent, it kind of doesn't matter.
Right.
And so how does the globe treat that? Does it begin to treat the rhetoric of the president like it does the rhetoric of a member of the Kim dynasty, right? Just sort of like this, he just talks this way, but that's no signal to policy. The difficulty is that the only ally, nominal ally that North Korea has is China. We are responsible for this like concert of alliances and agreements and pacts, and the rhetoric of the American president really does matter in coordination and sort of projecting and signaling our interests and our intentions. And I'm not sure what one does when a global superpower has basically a completely unreliable, rhetorically, head of state for whom you can't use their words as a basis for action. That problem exists domestically to a similar but less sort of like dire extent. Like, I think with healthcare, for example, Republican lawmakers had a difficult time actually figuring out what the president wanted. His rhetoric was not a reliable guide or signal. But that's just kind of, that's like this, like, a, I suppose Trump's supporters, the president's supporters would praise this as his unpredictability, but it really seems like kind of a crippling disadvantage.
Right.
This is the only way I can see in which this rhetoric helps, which is that if there's a plan to eventually try to work this out without getting into hostilities, that doing the chest puffing statement, the president gives the North Korean leader somebody, the North Korean leader, can then say, you know, see, I caused that guy to back down, like that it is a bit of a prize. This, I'm making this all up here, by the way. Boy, he was threatening me, but then look, I made him back down. And the size of the threat makes the back down seem that much more dramatic. But I'm making that up.
So you mean like Kim Jong-un in the end says, I was cowed?
No. Kim Jong-un in the end, if Kim Jong-un in the end works out some agreement, I have God knows what it would be. If you're trying to create an exit ramp for somebody, you try and create a conditions where they can claim victory. He would say, well, the United States backed down. And the thing he would use as measurement of the back down would not be anything substantive, but a future statement.
It would just be the bellicosity of the words.
Right. So the future statement by President Trump saying, I greatly respect the North Korean leader. And the North Korean leader would be able to say, see, he said he was going to like create fire and fury, but I got him now to say this really soft and loving thing about me. And if this is really all about like prestige, then you created an ability for him to back out and hold up as a prize the fact that he got this president to back down. And since the president doesn't matter, he doesn't mind saying things that people mock, he'll say this thing that people mock now as a way to create the precondition for that later scenario. I'm totally
but
making
that up.
But
you're not suggesting it's deliberate. You're saying
no, I'm making this up. I'm trying to find
effect.
I'm trying to if you take a thing that seems to have no strategic thought behind it and seems to be bad from all these different angles, and where experts on both sides say it's not that great. Although there are some people who say, like, this is the only thing that Kim Jong-un understands. But then I'm like, if it's the only thing he understands,
that seems wrong.
Well, there it also seems wrong, and it also seems, what's he supposed to understand from this? You made a threat and then didn't back it up. So what's the message? Like, so I understand if you're going for blunt force, then not backing it up seems to sap the strength of that. Anyway, I was just trying to define a way in which this might be strategically, but literally with I'm making that up. Can I just say one other thing, which is we should note that the technology here, although it's moved a lot faster than U.S. officials had thought, there does seem to be some question about whether they can build a missile that would have the reentry capability that could actually hit the United States. So getting the nuclear warhead on the top of the missile is one challenge. The Post suggests that they might be further along on that. But the idea that you basically shoot it in the air and then it wouldn't be able to succeed coming back down into the atmosphere.
Right.
So that just means the clock here is not immediate in terms of the actual nuclear threat.
It's almost kind of funny how something that seems as simple as launching an explosive object from point A to point B is actually super complicated.
Luckily.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
All right, let's move on to our second topic. Mayor Rahm Emanuel of Chicago sued the Justice Department on Monday over President Trump's threat to cut off federal grants for what are called sanctuary cities, places like Chicago. What Emanuel is saying is that the administration's threat is an attack on public safety and also the city's conscience. Attorney General Jeff Sessions hit back. He pointed out that street violence in Chicago and particularly homicides are on the rise there or have been on the rise and said, quote, no amount of federal taxpayer dollars will help a city that refuses to help its own residents. So here's what we're fighting over. We're fighting over a small but to cities somewhat significant amount of federal funding for various law enforcement programs. These are federal grants versus what the Trump administration wants, which is to give federal immigration agents full access to police stations and detention centers like jails and to provide 48 hours notice before releasing people who are wanted by ICE. So that's the tension here. Let's talk first about the politics. Is this just like, to be kind of cynical for a moment, a kind of win-win where you have these Democratic mayors, they represent places in which most people don't support Trump or his immigration policies, and they can kind of wave this flag of suing to get their law enforcement money, and it's kind of like a freebie for them. And if Jeff Sessions shakes his fist back at them. Well, like, everybody benefits politically. Is that, Jamel, do you think that's part of what's going on here, or am I just being way too cynical?
No, I think that's actually a fair analysis, because with this, everyone, all sides do seem to win politically. Big city mayors can say that they are, can show that they are turning their thumbs up at the Trump administration. And frankly, given, I think, the extent to which big city mayors have taken on this somewhat higher profile as political leaders for the Democratic Party, quite a few are positioning themselves as people who have ideas for moving the National Party forward. This helps undoubtedly. And Emanuel in particular has had a very fraught tenure as mayor of Chicago, and I think this might bolster his standing with at least some of his constituents. On the other side, Trump supporters hate sanctuary cities. This was a major stake. This is a major point in the campaign. And having Attorney General Sessions go after sanctuary cities and the mayors who defend them is undoubtedly a way of sort of showing the Trump White House, showing its constituents, its supporters, that it is carrying through on its promises and its rhetoric. The losers here, obviously, are actual immigrants, unauthorized immigrants, who already are facing this major crackdown from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I mean, very much caught in the middle here as basically political pawns.
I don't want to move on to this too quickly, but I'm interested in you, Emily, outlining legal issues here that go beyond this specific fight, just in terms of the administration's ability and any administration's ability to tell cities what to do. And obviously, this could turn on its head with conservatives like it now when it has to do with immigration. And the administration is anxious for fights on these kind of cultural areas, whether it's transgender issues or affirmative action or sanctuary cities, where, you know, they can keep encouraging their base. But if everything was reversed, you can imagine a Democratic president pushing Republican mayors — there aren't as many of them as Democratic mayors, I don't think — but to, you know, have transgender bathroom policies or whatever. So can you walk through the federalism issues here?
Yeah, I mean, there are some deep federalism issues, and you're right that you can switch sides based on what the policy is versus how much you think the structure of government really matters. So the Supreme Court has made it really clear that only Congress can impose conditions on grants that are given out to states and cities. And the conditions have to be unambiguously present in the text of the law, so the states can decide whether to take the money or not. And these come from cases in which states and cities have argued that they can't be what's called commandeered into doing the job of the federal government for them, and that their sovereignty means respecting decisions they make. So there's a difference between past grants and applying for future grants. And so the Trump administration has already sort of shifted by making this apply about applying for future money. But if the text of the statute that makes the grant available doesn't say anything about the precise kind of compliance with ICE's directives that the Trump administration is demanding, then, you know, you'd think the cities would have a pretty good legal leg to stand on here. And when we're thinking about how this could go in a different direction, transgender bathroom accommodations, you know, the federal order that the Department of Justice put out, that under the Obama administration, that's an example of liberals trying to push on states and localities a particular policy. You could also imagine this going into effect with gun control, yeah, which, you know, goes deep to the heart of the Trump base. So these questions about, you know, which level of government gets to control which happens where run through our whole system, and they can play out in unexpected ways. I have another set of questions I'm really interested in. I've been watching this to some degree unfold in Brooklyn. And this is about localities, particularly local district attorneys, wrestling with whether to change the way they charge people for low-level crimes and what kind of plea bargains they demand based on immigration consequences. So the acting DA in Brooklyn, whose name is Eric Gonzalez, he's running for election in November. He's been very out in front about this idea that it's important for his office to take into consideration the potential immigration consequences, in other words, deportation, if they charge people with crimes and in which the punishment is relatively serious. To some degree, because this is up to ICE and up to the feds about who they go after, it's out of the local DA's hands. I mean, if the Trump administration really does make a priority for deportation out of people who are charged with any offense, then it doesn't matter. But to some degree in the past, it has mattered whether you accepted a plea or took a sentence that was under a year in jail or prison versus over a year. And so Gonzalez has hired a couple of immigration rights attorneys who are working with his prosecutors to try to take into account how much risk of deportation you're creating when you charge someone. Dan Satterberg, the district attorney in Seattle, has been enacting similar policies for a while. It just raises a really interesting set of questions where, you know, on the one hand, you can argue as a district attorney, my responsibility is criminal law. I am not going to think about collateral consequences. If I think about immigrants being deported, then I also have to think about parents losing custody or someone not being able to be in the military or employed. There's always collateral damage from a criminal conviction. And yet I see why someone like Gonzalez would be who has a lot of immigrants in his community would be particularly concerned about this hunting that ICE is doing for people who face any kind of charges at all. And then we also have this question of which spaces in our society should be essentially safety zones for immigrants. So we're kind of used to the idea of churches and hospitals. Should courthouses also be places that ICE agents are not allowed to lurk? Right now, they're not allowed to go into the courtroom, but they can basically go up and try to, you know, take people off for detention who are in the hallways or in the bathrooms. And some DAs are saying, look, that means we're not going to be able to get people to come in as witnesses. We need these people to report crimes. We need to build their trust. And so that's like the sort of tension here. Jamel, what do you think about all of that, like playing out in these cities?
There really is like this vast web of offenses that in a real sense, most people probably break some kind of law on a daily basis. And it's just a matter of whether or not authorities want to pursue it. And when all of a sudden someone for whom, you know, a minor offense in the past may have just meant effectively a kind of slap on the wrist, but now all of a sudden this may end in their deportation from the country. You have to grapple with that punitiveness and like, what do you do about it? How do you avoid this like very harsh consequence for offenses that may not in the scheme of things be a big deal? If you know, some 19-year-old kid shoplifts, should he be deported? I think most people would say absolutely not. But that's sort of what the situation people are looking at. So there's that. There's the kind of ironic consequences of the Trump administration's emphasis on deportation, which makes fighting actual crime in immigrant communities much more difficult. It's actually very easy to imagine this creating a spiral where the absence of violent crime enforcement in immigrant communities empowers violent criminals and kind of creates zones that are effectively lawless because no one's willing to talk or cooperate. I mean, this is not a crazy thing. This basically describes a lot of inner city jurisdictions like in inner city Baltimore and South Central LA, where distrust of police has made solving violent crime so difficult as to create effective impunity for violent criminals.
So, John, what do you think about the politics here? I mean, my fear is that it's just more and more polarized, that people who, you know immigrants or are part of communities like the ones Jamel's describing have one set of impressions about this, and then people who are removed from that reality and the fear that comes with it might be much more likely to say, look, these people are here illegally, you know, tough. And if their families are being broken up, that's because of choices they've made. Do you have a sense that, you know, immigration continues to just be this issue that like divides people and we kind of can't really move beyond those divisions? Or do you feel like that there is a solution and we just like haven't quite found the will to reach it?
Well, as long as it's being adjudicated in the electoral context, everybody's who wants a solution is doomed, because if these are seen as ways to whip up the base, then, you know, then people will copy that. It will, and the administration will keep doing it. So in that environment, you don't get reasoned debate about the trade-offs necessary. And also, like we've seen at the federal level, I mean, the issue is completely gone in terms of Congress, in terms of any kind of immigration reform. This is where it lives for a while.
This just seems to me like such a ginned up conflict. I mean, Congress was close to comprehensive immigration reform. When you look at the polls, most people think we should figure out some kind of legal accommodation for most of the folks who are here undocumented already. There aren't tons of people pouring over the borders. That is something that the president can actually take some credit for, because his anti-immigrant rhetoric does seem to have discouraged some of the people who might have otherwise come in. And immigrants are such a tremendous force of contribution to our society. They commit crimes at lower levels, etc. Like, there's just all these elements for like a perfectly good compromise that would be good for the economy, good for like the demographic health of America going forward. And yet we have this demonizing. And then I think also on the left, less and less interest in talking about setting limits, because there are all these heartbreaking stories that make the limits seem like they're really not the point right now. Before we move on to our third topic, I want to give a huge shout out to the Slate Culture Fest. If you guys are not already listening to Stephen Metcalf and Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, you are seriously missing out. This is one of my favorite podcasts. I rely on these guys to tell me what to go and see, or to fill in the holes of the vast gaps, I should say, in my cultural knowledge, by cluing me into things that I'm not going to have time to go check out for myself, but want to be able to have some sense of. They are just sharp and insightful and witty and super fun to listen to. If my endorsement isn't good enough, the New York Times critic Dwight Garner says that the Slate Culture Gab Fest is one of the highlights of his week. You guys should really go subscribe to the Culture Fest if you have not done so already.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's move on to our third topic. The Google engineer James Damore wrote a memo this week, a kind of 10-page manifesto that posted on an internal Google message board and then leaked and went viral. It was a series of complaints about efforts to recruit and employ more women at Google, making a kind of, I would say, cursory and not well evidence-based argument that not all women, but women on average, don't have what it takes to be really good computer engineers, because they're just biologically different in men that prevents them from succeeding on average in to the same level as men, that they're more interested in social and artistic pursuits, and that the stress of high pressure jobs is not a good fit for them on average. So this guy, James Damore, was fired by Google several days after this memo came to light. He has submitted a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board saying that Google retaliated against him and that his firing was illegal. Now the rest of us are kind of sorting through what to make of all of this. Jamel, I guess, first of all, should we talk about the ideas in this memo? I guess we sort of have to do that. I feel very impatient with that, because I feel like we've had this discussion before, and this is like a poorly written and thought through representation of some stale notions. But I guess maybe we should start there, though I'm also interested in your thoughts about whether Damore should have been fired.
Yeah, I think it's worth starting with the ideas in the memo. What's interesting to me is I think they are quite stale, right? That it's a pretty rote argument about the biological nature of stereotypically feminine traits like caring and, you know, community building and cooperation, and apparently neurosis was thrown in there. And this
yes,
is
I didn't
connect-
know about that one. That was new.
Yeah,
to me.
That was new to me. This is connected to a larger complaint about Google's efforts at diversity, and the argument is that there is no point in Google trying to find or seek out women who are engineers or computer scientists, given the lack of the difference in average abilities. And in fact, it is discriminatory towards white men to have programs, affirmative action programs, mentorship programs, so on and so forth, directed at women and minorities. So he makes that argument. And then he also says that what Google ought to focus on is what he calls viewpoint diversity, that the actual diversity that counts is ideological diversity, is political diversity. It is important for Google to take affirmative measures to both increase the representation of ideological conservatives on Google's staff and also make conservatives already on staff feel comfortable about expressing themselves.
John, what was your reaction to all of this? Did you make it through this poorly written
I
memo?
Did make it through
I had trouble
it.
I, reading the whole
so
thing.
What it seemed to me that he was saying was, there are two things at play here. There is a debate about how to have a debate. That's one thing. That was the meta point he was making. And for me, that was the first point he was making, was it was about the debate. He then chose to use facts and arguments within that debate, which were either wrong or objectionable, and that killed his larger point. Now,
whereas the echo chamber question was an interesting one, right?
But then, in a sense, that affirmed his argument, which was you can't even mention these things without them swamping your larger point. And so then he's fired for trying to mention these things. And that further affirms his global point, which was, look, the Google is too far to the left. And in trying to ameliorate the disparities, which I believe he a few times, I felt like throughout the internal memo, he kept trying to say, look, I'm not saying what you are going to think I'm saying by mentioning these things. Like he believes in pay parity and in diversity and in efforts to ameliorate the gender disparities. His argument was that because the approach to doing so was so liberal and didn't allow for other kinds of arguments, that it was going to be ineffective. And so when he said other kinds of arguments, which are that basically gender disparity doesn't exist solely because of the actions of the company, that there are other, and then this is where he goes in and lists the biological and the emotional and all of that, which I saw as an effort. I mean, he may believe all those things, but let's imagine for just a second that he doesn't. And his argument is only there's more to this conversation than the way in which it's discussed here at Google. And so we have to at least address those other issues or at least create an environment where someone can raise them, if for no other reason than having a bunch of other people say, no, you're wrong for reasons X, Y, and Z. And that in the end, if you can have that kind of conversation, it makes the ultimate policies you put in place far more durable. While he may be wrong in the individual facts he cites, he's not the only one who holds them. And again, the central claim being that there's more to gender disparity than simply the policies of the company. And I thought his plea for kind of a broader conversation was, you know, I mean, it's a plea I make myself, if again, for no other reason than to squeeze out bad thinking. And the response from Google, I thought the official at Google who responded started by saying, I'm not even going to link to his argument because I don't agree with it.
Yeah, that was
as if retweets were endorsements. That's affirming his underlying critique, which is they're not engaging with these ideas. They're just saying these ideas are objectionable. They're not the kind of ideas that we, the right-thinking people, have, and therefore we're going to just roll past them.
Yeah, I mean, I think they made a mistake by firing him, because I think that at-will employment, including in private companies, should have more protections for free speech. And I think that essentially this was like, you might be doing every other piece of your work well. You haven't, as far as we know, taken any actions to undermine women in your workplace, but you said this stuff that makes it clear that you have these ideas about biological differences that we, Google, think are socially unacceptable. So goodbye to you. I just did not think that was like a good, really liberal move on the part of the company. And I was also irritated by the whole, we're not even going to engage with these ideas, because there are all these obvious retorts to the ideas. It's just that some of them are actually not helpful to Google because they have to do with the incredibly bro-y culture of, I'm sure, the company in particular, but also Silicon Valley in general.
So on the question of his firing, I mean, I'm sort of tied between the two sides here, but I think I will say that because the memo included a set of recommendations, and I'll say one thing that frustrated me about the memo is that Damore would prefer sections like, well, of course, I think diversity is good, and I'm not trying to say that Google should have less. Here are some recommendations for how. But then his actual recommendations were eliminate programs that help integrate, you know, women and non-white candidates at Google, suggestions that hiring for a diverse cohort lowers the bar of standards at Google. I mean, sort of his yes. recommendations weren't recommendations. They were simply arguments for eliminating anything that has been shown to address these disparities in a substantive way. And when you couple that with the actual argument in the memo, I do sort of see the case for, listen, how do we know if this guy is in a position to evaluate candidates that he is going to be fair-minded at all? His decision to not just write the memo, but to circulate it amongst his colleagues renders him basically a lawsuit waiting to happen for Google. And so I should say
Google is already facing a potential class action from pay discrimination. Altshuler Burzin, which is a prominent firm that takes these kinds of cases in California, is interviewing women and says it has talked to 70 women and has some reason to think there is pay disparity. Sorry, go ahead.
No, but that's a good point. I mean, there's legitimate legal liability here that I think Google has to take into consideration. So that's just on the firing point. I go back and forth with myself about this notion of engaging with ideas like this. And that's partly because my experience with this particular issue is in terms of the conversation around, or the arguments around race and racial inequality and the ongoing sort of disparities between African Americans and white Americans and sort of other racial groups and white Americans. And in these arguments and conversations, there is sort of the, you know, sociological, historical explanation for all of this that is generally accepted among academics and has a tremendous amount of support behind it. And then there are these, you know, recurring arguments about sort of the cultural deficiency of Black Americans, or potentially even the genetic deficiency of Black Americans, that have been roundly debunked a lot, have been debunked every time they pop up, and they pop up sort of on a cycle going back to the beginnings of disciplines like sociology. And for me, it feels increasingly unreasonable to ask, why don't you just debate that instead of shutting it down? The only purpose it serves is to treat those ideas as legitimate when they really aren't anymore, if they ever were. They have been debunked, they have been challenged, and their recurring presence in conversations is less about the fact that they may have hold any truth and more about the fact that they serve a particular set of ideological and group interest. Damore's memo is relying on ideas and arguments about women that are very faulty, that have been debunked, that have been challenged. And I am somewhat uncomfortable with the idea that there's an obligation to debate those ideas when they've been debated.
Larry Summers, the former right. president of Harvard, made a similar, better supported argument a few years ago and got fired from Harvard, though that hardly blocked his professional advancement thereafter.
Well, I think what the point about elevating ideas, it's not just that they're noxious, it's that by debating them, you are actually conveying value on them greater than they should get, is a super important point. Because we do that, I mean, in trying to cover politicians, there's that too, where people say crazy stuff in the hopes that you'll debate them on it, because you've immediately taken the crazy thing and put it on a legitimate plane. But then the other side of that is you have the problem that people don't, in their daily lives, they have things that they believe, right, which is that everybody is equal, and they sort of believe those things. They don't know why they believe them. And so that makes one susceptible to, like, huh, well, maybe that's right. Like, in other words, not everybody comes with the understanding of why these various things have been debunked. And so then what do you do with that situation right. where somebody hears the argument and then needs the argument to be extinguished with facts so that they can, like, not think, well, you know, so that they can go through the process because they just don't, you know, they aren't familiar with the sociology or the whatever.
I think that there is something to that. I mean, Jamel, I'm super sympathetic to the idea that pernicious claims that have almost no evidence behind them or have been debunked again and again are like a waste of time. On the other hand, when they surface in specific situations like this one, to me, it's useful to for example, be reminded that, you know, women actually were leaders among computer scientists in the 1980s. And then we started to see a decline in their participation and in how much they were at the forefront of this Silicon Valley world. And like the difference between the 1980s and now is not genetic or biological. It's cultural. And so then that reminds us of like thinking about these structural questions. I guess I also kept flashing to these interviews I did a couple of years ago with a whole bunch of women at Stanford who were computer science majors and were entering this world. You know, these are like incredibly talented people, right? I mean, they're studying this stuff at Stanford. They were just impressive as a group. I was talking to like five or six of them, and their concerns were about the bro culture in the Valley. I mean, it was partly because I was interviewing them about issues around sexual harassment. But, you know, Katie Brenner for the New York Times has done a whole new sort of series on this lately. And when you're in a culture in which there is this kind of relentless possibility that you're going to be not taken seriously, that people are going to be like assuming that you're there as dating material as opposed to really code, that has an effect. And so I just felt like if I thinking about those women, what they would need in response to this memo, I mean, they, I think, are all smart enough to kind of like shrug and not imagine that this means that they're not worthy and deserving of whatever they're doing now. But I do think that reminding people about the history of the Valley and the role that women played at an earlier stage and they no longer do is kind of important. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, maybe that is all well and good. And it's not the same as like going down the rabbit hole of like explaining why the one study about how boys grab trucks and girls look at faces more isn't like the reason not to try to recruit women into computer science jobs.
I think that's fair. Like, I think it's, I don't know. This is why I go back and forth between it, because I think in specific circumstances, it may be useful to say, you know, listen, this is why this particular argument is wrong. I mean, I kind of alluded to it earlier. But the simple fact that Damore seems to be confusing, you know, like, going from this is an average trait to therefore that there is impossible to find a sufficient population of women engineers and computer scientists. It's just like a very classic logical error. It's like an elementary logical error. And there's definitely yes. value in putting that kind of stuff out. And I think I should say, I don't know why Google, the folks at Google decided to say, we're not even going to debate this. My hunch is that I don't want to project my particular sense for why it is not necessarily useful to debate these ideas onto Google's decision making.
I mean, because also this was an opportunity. Usually when we have these debates, it's the women themselves or the black people who are being judged inferior who have to like make the patient, no, here's where you're wrong. Here are all my footnotes argument. This is a chance for the company to do that.
Right.
And I guess I think it would be more meaningful for them to be out there fighting that fight than like, you know, essentially fire this guy as a symbol of their great commitment to diversity, which is like an easy thing to make him take the hit as opposed to saying, look, here's the answer to these questions. Here's what's fundamentally wrong with this culture. We are a part of that. Here is what we're actually doing to change it. We're going to take a close look at whether there's gender pay disparity here. Maybe that deeper conversation is going on internally, but we're not seeing evidence of that.
Don't we assume the lawyers got involved here too? That if you allow this memo to exist, that if you're being sued potentially or a class action lawsuit's on the offing, that not taking severe measures can be used as evidence of a workplace environment in which these ideas are tolerated, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jamel's point about that earlier was a good one. And I don't think that this guy is going to win his complaint with the NLRB if it goes forward, just given the freedom to fire people that at-will employment brings with it.
Can I just throw one quick thing in and then we'll go back on the conversation? Is the point Jamel made and that we were talking about there about elevating crazy ideas, it feels like to me that the teaching of logic, at least to have a common language which allows quicker dispensing of things. I mean, in this memo talks about confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, but to the extent that more of these debates happen in the public space, in social media, and regular old people chime in, more and broader education about a common language about how to basically dispense with or at least classify certain kinds of argumentation seems to me to be more important than ever. I mean, in the old days, it was just for debating societies, but now everything is a debating society, and it can take a half an hour to walk through confirmation bias. If everybody knew what it was and could identify it, yes or no, then you'd like get to the other meaty part of the argument a lot faster.
Right. I think that's
I think that's an excellent aspiration.
And I will say strategically for Google or tactically that the problem with firing him is it makes Dave Moore, precisely because these ideas about biological difference or inferiority, which as a quick parenthetical, there's a defense here that Dave Moore doesn't say that women are inferior, therefore it is unfair to attribute that to him. But for my part, if I were to write a memo saying that the reason why Black Americans do more physical manual labor or overrepresented in professional sports because they are naturally more gifted at physical pursuits. But and I don't say, but I never say that makes them inferior. Like, I don't think it's still the case that I'm drawing like an insane, I'm making an insane claim here that is rooted in ideas of inferiority. Firing Dave Moore makes him a martyr, and avoiding martyrdom for these ideas is like a good thing. And I think if anything, that's the reason why Google shouldn't have fired him.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
John, whatever drink, cool, nice drink you plan to hold in your hand this weekend, what will you be talking about with those near and dear to you?
I'm hoping I have a chance to hold a cocktail in my hand on the weekend, but
Sunday night, isn't that your
Sunday
new
night? That's
hour?
True. Does that still count as the weekend?
Yeah, totally. For you, it has to.
Yeah, right. My cocktail chatter is about something called crown shyness, which I learned about from the writer Robert McFarlane, who tweeted about it. And basically, it's a phenomenon where trees grow up together and then they avoid overlapping or touching. Hmm. And what this does is it creates these beautiful, also, by the way, so crown shyness, just in terms of an expression for this phenomenon, is so gorgeous. And the other one is canopy disengagement. The etymologists in horticulture are really like, they've got it going on. But it creates these beautiful pictures of, or not pictures, but the trees when they align have between them what look like little rivers of space so that they don't touch each other. So they grow all together and create this beautiful canopy with just tiny little rivers between the trees where they aren't touching. And I encourage everybody to go type crown shyness into their favorite search engine and just look at these pictures and then maybe find your way someday to a place that has it. And it just seems to me to be a beautiful and peaceful and gorgeous piece of nature.
That is very lovely. Jamel, tell us about your cool tall drink and your cocktail chatter.
It's the summer, so I'm totally a rosé drinker. So that's what I would have in my hand. So whenever I'm on here, I always either mention a film or a camera. And so I'm going to mention a camera this time since last time I mentioned a film. I recently picked up a Graflex Crown Graphic, which is an old press camera, a large format 4x5 press camera. Like you see, you know, if you've seen LA Confidential, the cameras that they use in there are, that's what that is, the press camera made by an American company up in Rochester up until the 70s, basically until the company folded. And I got one just because I was interested in large format photography, which refers to the size of the negative. In this case, the negative is roughly 4 inches by 5 inches, which means that it captures like an incredible amount of visual information that makes for really rich and beautiful photographs. And so that is what I've been playing with for the last month. It is a lot of fun. It is very cumbersome kind of photography. The actual camera is large and heavy. To actually get the film to the camera, you have to load it in these film holders. You have to make sure they're very clean or dust will get everywhere. You have to do this in complete darkness or you'll expose the film, obviously. Then once you have your film loaded, you maybe have, you know, four to six or eight shots with you to use for a given outing. It's very cumbersome. It's very slow. I have to have a
and
tripod
yet,
with me.
Worth
and
it
yet, depends. And yet, it is just a different way of taking pictures. It is forcing you to slow down almost to like molasses, to really think about the image you're trying to capture, to really think about what you're trying to do with your photography. I haven't had a chance to take one of these negatives into the darkroom to actually make a print, but I'm looking forward to doing that as well and kind of utilizing the negative space to make something pretty cool. So that's Jamel's old, like weird and cumbersome hobbies.
Nice.
Is my cocktail chair.
A series.
Can I just say one wonderful thing about Jamel's weird and cumbersome hobbies that is that I find so appealing and envy so much is that somebody...
Because you also have weird and cumbersome hobbies.
Well, but so here's the problem.
Speaking one to another.
The thing
here.
Is, I don't really. I don't have them in the way Jamel does. And this is came home to me. The I was talking
envy.
To a friend who recently told a story about Paul Newman and said, basically, Paul Newman, if you met him, hated to talk about acting. Like, would not... Just the wrong thing to do would be say, tell me about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But if you said anything about car racing, he would be yours for like an hour of in-depth conversation about that passion of his. And so this person said, so what's your version of car racing? And I was at a loss for an immediate response. And so
music.
I felt that whole, yeah, I know. But anyway, I don't know. Anyway, hearing Jamel and watching his Instagram feed about photography and also about food, I just like that's everybody should have those. So if you don't have them, go get them.
Okay, so that makes my cocktail chatter so lame because it's a total busman's holiday cocktail chatter, but I'm going to go with it anyway. In the sort of Justice Department watch that is like a part of my week every week, the main event this week was that the Justice Department switched sides in a lawsuit in Ohio over what steps that the state has to take to purge the voting rolls. So this has to do with the National Voter Registration Act, and Ohio wants to make it relatively easy to kick people off the voting rolls. Ohio's idea is that if you don't vote twice in a row, like over 2 years, even if you haven't sent in any notice that you moved or your registration has changed, the state can send you a notice. And then if you don't respond, and then if you don't vote for a few more years, they can just scrub you from the rolls. The Justice Department had been arguing that that's not a correct interpretation of this law, that the state has to have some signal that the voters have moved or died or something happened to them. They can't just use essentially a pattern of not voting as the reason to kick someone off the rolls. But lo and behold, the Trump administration has reconsidered that position, and now the Justice Department is in this case on the side of Ohio, on the side of making it easier to kick people off the rolls. And lo and behold, most of the people who are being purged from the rolls in Ohio are, they're disproportionately low income, and they tend to be Democrats. You know, this is just one of the biggest kind of simmering questions that we are continually confronting in this administration, and not just in this administration, about whether we want to be a country that makes it harder or easier to vote, whether we're going to let these almost entirely unfounded fears of voter fraud drive a push to push people off the voting rolls. So let's keep an eye on that Ohio lawsuit, which is probably bound for the Supreme Court one of these days, sooner rather than later. The Political Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher, at least for a little bit longer, is the wonderful Kevin Townsend. Please subscribe to the Gabfest in Apple Podcasts and review and rate the show while you're there. That really helps us find new listeners, and we super appreciate it. For John Dickerson and Jamel Bowie, I'm Emily Bazelon. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk with you again next week.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.